LSE time, 5 minutes past. So welcome and thank you all for coming. Just to let everyone know that the audio is being recorded for a podcast. So before we begin, I just want to take a moment to thank the Department of International Relations for hosting this event and the speakers for coming to join us today. So this includes Dr. Jennifer Egert from the University of Warwick, Dr. Karim Lisensiaglu from SOAS, Professor Robbie Shilliam from Queen Mary, and Professor Karen Smith from the LSE, and of course Dr. Joanne Yao from Durham University. The speakers have been given 10 to 15 minutes to talk and were asked to address issues including but not limited to why issues of gender and diversity matter to the discipline and higher education, whether the international relations syllabi can be decolonized, and can women and racialized minorities be written in. In addition, we asked them to think about what policies can we undertake as a community and in our own teaching and research practice to counter the silencing of underrepresented voices and develop a more diverse discipline, and how we can ensure that the drive for a more inclusive academy does not depoliticize and naturalize rather than dismantle and transform the very structures of white and elite scholarship. So in putting together the themes of the roundtable today, we recognize that conversations around these questions have been gaining traction, most recently coming to the foreground on the picket lines of the UCU pension strike, but also among our students who in some cases have self-organized to take on questions of Eurocentrism and diversity in the curricula. Nevertheless, there is concern that these conversations have been falling flat or have been taking place in an echo chamber of sorts. As racist and misogynist attacks on university campuses are discussed when they come to light but then quickly forgotten, and where the gender pay gap is still blatant, obvious, and we accept slight diminutions in the disparity as a victory. And where gender and diverse labor is not rewarded for the same level as masculinized competition, particularly with regards to the benchmarks established by the TEF and the REF. On that note, I will leave it to the speakers to respond and then open up the conversation for a 30-minute Q&A. So thank you. Joanne, would you like to start?
Hello, everyone. It's good to be back and see so many friendly and familiar faces. I'd like to thank Andrew for inviting me and Ida,
who couldn't be here
because she's having fun in sunny California without us, for inviting me. I realize I have very big shoes to fill because Patricia Owens couldn't be here at the moment, so we were asked to kind of step in, but I'm in no way going to be able to fill those shoes. So instead of trying to do so, what I'm going to talk about is a bit about what I've learned since I've begun my position at Durham. So those of you who do know me, I finished my PhD here at the LSE about a year and a half ago. And then since September, I've taken up a position, assistant professorship at Durham University, which is only 3 short hours away on the train, so it's nice to be able to come back. I'd like to focus my comments on kind of what I've been thinking about and what I've learned in the last 6 months in terms of beginning to convene my own courses and beginning to be responsible for my own syllabi. So I think I would want to address my comments around two big issues. One is that representation matters. And the second one is that process matters. So I kind of structure my comments around those things. My race and cultural background have not really been central to my scholarship. Indeed, I've always rebelled against the idea that I should do China studies or Asian studies. And I think, looking back on things I've done in the past, I've worked for the U.S. government, I've worked for international NGOs, in many ways, I don't feel like my background, racial background or gender, has really hindered so much of what I've done before. beyond the usual comment, which is like, oh, you must be the new China analyst. Then they find out that it's not true, and then they just, you know, go on with their lives. I think it's been fun because in those jobs, I was competent and I did my job and I met the targets and everything was hunky-dory. I think academia is different. And I think there's a larger performative aspect to what we do in the classroom. I've never kind of experienced this before where every aspect of what I do is judged. And that it's the entire package. It's a performance before the students. And in this context, I feel like to be able to do a good job has taken on a variety of factors that I hadn't really experienced before, including my gender and my race, being involved in how I do a good job in the classroom. For me, it's been a bit of a disorientating process, I would say. I feel like I'm just as passionate in my discussions of, you know, rules, norms, sovereignty, all those great concepts we like talking about, but as I am in discussing other concepts like gender and post-colonialism. And yet after the lecture and during office hours, it's young women who come to me and speak to me about wanting to do their dissertations on gender. And it's the young brown women who come to me and ask me if I want to supervise their dissertation on post-colonialism. After my first lecture, which to 120 undergrads in their first week of university, I was talking about something I knew very little about, but a young Asian girl came up to me afterwards and said, "It's nice to see an Asian face in a position of authority." Suddenly I realized it's a terrible sense of responsibility. I think in many ways it's inspired me to try harder because I didn't want to be the only Asian woman teaching IR in the department and do a bad job. But these experiences, I think, remind me daily of the importance of representation because it's so important in our normative framing of possibility, what is possible in my life. And I think it's intimately related to empowerment and self-actualization for students. I've tried to integrate this in many ways in my teaching practice, from small things to big things. So some small things I, consciously try to do is to put up pictures of females and minority scholars, even if I'm just talking about, topics that usually you would see pictures of Mearsheimer, Cohen, or Wendt. One example was we were talking about the Montevideo Conference, which is an important conference in 1933. It's known for this legal definition that came about of what a state is, independent of recognition from other states. And, we talked about it in previous lectures, but what really is never really mentioned is the U.S. representative to this conference, Dr. Sophie, I'm going to butcher this name, Sofonspa Breckenridge. She was the first female representative of the U.S. at an international conference. And that's very, we talk about this conference a lot because of its importance for definitions of what statehood means, and yet we don't always necessarily recognize this other aspect. She, looking into her, I didn't know anything about her until I stumbled upon her. And looking into her, she's so impressive, right? She's the first woman to earn a PhD in political science and economics and a JD at the University of Chicago. And she is the first woman to be admitted to the Kentucky Bar and first woman at an international conference representing the U.S. So, these small aspects of what my practice, 30 seconds of remembrance of Dr. Breckenridge is little enough to really affect the needle when we're talking about perhaps normative framing and representation. Just like hiring me is little enough in addressing daunting questions of gender and diversity in the greater academy. But if politics is the slow boring of hard boards, then perhaps normative emancipation is somewhat similar, that it's these small acts over and over again that can really do move the needle. Some big things that I've tried to do in my practice, and I'm at the very beginning of hopefully a long academic journey, is addressing the syllabus, which to me requires going back to being a student. So taking roads that I'm not familiar with, that I haven't really, intellectual paths that I haven't really explored in my research. It requires asking others, relying on my friends who are more knowledgeable about this, who know about decolonized syllabi and decolonized reading lists out there in on the internet and elsewhere that they're willing to share. It involves taking chances, trying new scholarship and new angles that I'm not familiar with and not 100% certain would work, but really taking those chances and trying them out on the students and see if if it sticks, right? If it works or it doesn't. Some readings students get, some readings they don't get, along a lot of things. And I also, in my teaching, try to think about the diversity of methods as well. So how you convey a point across to students, whether it's direct lecture, of course, and then question and answer, but also different ways of setting up the argument. Fear and awe is one way you could do it, I think, but also kind of opening up the conversation into a more interrogative, critical way, maybe a different way of making your argument known. And lastly, something I'm thinking about is the diversification of the curriculum, which I think requires institutional buy-in. And this requires us to apply our scholarship on, you know, we all sit around and study quite a bit about how institutions work and how social norms work, and it requires us to take that insight into kind of states in the international system, perhaps, and apply it to the institutions we find ourselves in, such as the LSE or this department, which takes me to the second aspect of what I want to talk about, which is the virtues in the process. So perhaps this betrays me as perhaps not a natural revolutionary to be on the streets and on the barricades, but one of the reasons I think that the LSE Gender and Diversity Group and the syllabus coding project that I've been privileged to help lead, and now embarking on a similar project in Durham, these projects are good, despite it kind of telling us what we already know. And this is one of the pushbacks that I get a lot. Well, you know, what you're going to find is that the syllabus is biased, and we already know that. So why are you doing this entire project? And I think I'd like to defend the virtues of the process of doing this. It generates ownership and buy-in. So I'm going to say, think about it generating ownership and buy-in first in terms of the coders. So a lot of the comments from the coders are, oh, I had no idea it was this bad. So this realization that by doing it, you finally realize how bad it is. You knew it before, but you know, when you code, you actually get into the nitty-gritties of it. Generating buy-in from the funders. Somebody's funding, perhaps the coders or the project. This is all about making your case to power. And finally, generating ownership amongst the latent support within an institution. A lot of people perhaps tacitly support moving the needle in terms of gender and diversity, but never really took it upon themselves to necessarily start this project or start this process. So getting buy-in from them, trying to include their project or their ideas into the project, trying to kind of get them on board and be part of the momentum. So again, the process is really important, I think, for me, is generating ownership. The other important thing I think the process does is it jumpstarts the conversation for the hard cases in the department. So hard cases include, for me, at least from my experience, the quants, I call them. So their usual pushback is, where's the evidence? So in projects like this, we can come back and say, yes, we are actually generating evidence. Here's some concrete evidence that we can show you. The overworked and overwhelmed. So these are the people who come back to us and say, I don't have time for this. I know this is important, but this is the same syllabus I use every year. I don't get time to, you know, sit down and redo my syllabus every year. This is not in my workload model. I don't have time for this. And this allows us to generate a conversation about, well, different ways that perhaps it wouldn't take so much of your time, perhaps a little bit per year might move the needle a little bit. And there are ways to kind of address those concerns in terms of the overworked and the overwhelmed. Another sort of hard case are the individualists. These are the it's my syllabus, and you can infringe on my intellectual freedom. And I think, again, it's important to sit down with these people and say, well, it is your syllabus, and it is your choice of who you put on it, but let's have a conversation about who you've included, and perhaps we can talk about why you've included some of these people and why you've excluded others. At the end of the day, it is your choice of who you've put on a syllabus, but perhaps we can kind of change your mind about a few of these authors. Another kind of hard case are the box checkers. These are the add minorities and stir people. They're like, okay, well, we want to improve our gender balance from 20% and 80% to 30%. So let's see. Oh, we'll just move some women up. We'll take some women out, and we'll crunch the maths, and somehow it'll work out, and we will have improved and diversified a syllabus. So I think it's important to kind of address this group as well in the process, and this is part of the virtues of the process, is to kind of have a conversation about what diversity means and whether it's enough to just add minorities and stir. And finally, the realists, it's too big of a problem for us to solve. It's a systemic tragedy. I'm sure all of you are familiar with this argument, and that we as individuals can't do anything about it. And I think it's important to address these people's concerns as well, because they have a good point. It is a systemic issue, but perhaps there is something we as individuals, as individual departments, as individual universities, as, you know, an academic community can do, start to push the needle once again. So that by the time we have concrete results on these problems, we have already worked on many of the aims of the project, which include to raise awareness, to gain institutional buy-in, to imagine possibilities to improve diversity, and to create a more inclusive conversation. And ultimately, I like to conclude by saying that there is no ideal, perfect syllabus. Diversity always will and should be an open question. I feel like I know my syllabus personally, and the ones I'm in charge of are not diverse enough. I know that. And I feel like for me, what success looks like is not a conclusion to this conversation and the perfect syllabus, but the continued intensity of self-reflection and discussion about what diversity is, what inclusion looks like, and directions our discipline can go in to study this international in all its nuanced variations. Thank you.
And microphone. Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, hi everyone. It's great to be here. I was really excited when Andrew asked me if I wanted to join the panel. 5 minutes after I hit send on that "yay, I'll join" email, I started freaking out a bit because I had to look at the profiles of the other speakers, which pretty much all seem to have a background in decolonial theory, which is not really my area of expertise, and it's a British way of saying it. The Germany would have said, I don't know much about it. But then I did think about it a bit longer, and I thought that, no, I still have something to contribute, and that's my personal experience as a visible Muslim woman, as a mother, a foreigner, a non-native speaker, as an early career researcher in extremely precarious working conditions, and also as a practitioner who's worked in widening participation both with pupils and with students, with Muslim students who have arrived at university and who are trying to survive. So that's the perspective which I'm going to share with you today. I've tried to order my thoughts because there's so many things I want to say, there's so many things I want to share, there's so many things that make me extremely angry. But I tried to boil it all down to 5 points. The first one is that context matters. Personally, for a long time, I did not experience sexism or Islamophobia. At least I didn't see it. I didn't notice it. Looking back, I feel that for many years, I was actually favored as a woman, and that things were made easy for me as a woman, that I had it easier. And as when we speak about Islamophobia, I really didn't experience it for a long time. I did my undergrad in a very small town in Eastern Germany, 7,000 students. When I started studying there, I was the only woman wearing hijab. I didn't know any Muslims. I had no Muslim friends. There was no Muslim infrastructure. Later on, I found out that there were actually 2 Muslim families who lived in the city, but that was it. I was basically on my own, and I had a time of my life. It was amazing. I was extremely popular. I had lots of friends. And it's just, I just didn't feel that I was different in any way. I always felt welcome. I always felt part of everything. I felt respected. It was just no issue whatsoever. Things changed when, after 2 years of studying there, I moved to Paris for my year abroad. I was still almost the only visibly Muslim woman at the university. There were, I think, 3 hijabis at the university of 7,000 students. But obviously, Paris is a city that has lost quite a strong Muslim presence. And this is when, for the first time, I started facing Islamophobia, and people were making direct comments. People at the university, professors, people on the street. And that's really the first time that I realized that something was wrong. So that would be my first point. Context matters. And your experience can vary. You're still the same person, but depending on the context that you are in, and depending on the situation that you're in, your experience can just vary extremely. I've lived in Germany, I've lived in the UK, I've lived in France, I've lived in a couple of Middle Eastern and South Asian countries, and I was always pretty much the same person, but my experiences weren't. So I think that's important to bear in mind, and not to make any assumptions based on, oh, she's the only Muslim woman, he's the only black student at his university. But what is the context like? Yeah, what is the situation? That's my first point. Second point is, I was smiling when you spoke about the overwork and overwhelmed, because that's so me. I'm so extremely tired. Partly that has to do with the very precarious working conditions that I mentioned earlier, but it also has to do with the fact that I'm a woman, and it has to do with the fact that I'm a mother, and it has to do with the fact that I'm a Muslim woman, and it has to do with the fact that I'm a foreigner and a non-native speaker, and so on. The older I become, the more aware I become of oppressive structures that are around me. I'm not sure if there are more now, or if I just didn't see it earlier. I'm not sure if you become more sensitive with time. I'm not sure if it maybe has to do with the fact that you, as you grow older, become more confident, so become more annoying. And I'm definitely very annoying sometimes in the eyes of some people, because I say stuff and I call out people. And maybe it has to do with that, the backlash you face from people who are not happy when you call them out for their Islamophobic or racist or sexist comments. I'm not sure. I'm still trying to figure that out. I'm extremely tired of microaggressions in my everyday life. So seemingly small things that people say and do, it can just be looks sometimes. We're speaking about the ISA, the annual conference of the International Studies Association, that I attended for the first time last year. And it was just the looks. People didn't actually say anything, but just the way of looking you up and down, that makes you, that just shows you that you're not considered to be part, you're not considered, this is not a space that was where people expect to see people like you. Yeah. So I'm tired of the microaggressions, of the fact that others don't seem to see, and that others don't say anything. I'm so tired of being the only person in the room that says something, and again and again and again. I'm so tired of hearing absolute nonsense being said in passing by someone who, of course, has only good intentions, but it still happens. And I'm tired of seemingly being the only person who notices. I'm tired of sitting there for the entire remainder of this workshop or meeting or whatever it is, not being able to focus as much as I would want to on the content, but thinking, okay, should I say something now? What did she say? Did she mean that? Is this a problem? Is this not? If I say something now, am I again going to be the angry Jennifer who always says something? I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm extremely tired. I'm tired of my background is in conflict and terrorism studies. I'm tired of seeing yet another panel on Islamist terrorism, and everyone on this panel is white and non-Muslim. I'm tired of equality and diversity committees that are super aware when it comes to people's sexual identity. And they can explain to you exactly the difference between gender and sex and this and that, but with no understanding whatsoever of the experiences of a student of faith. I'm just really tired. My list is, I have 10 more points on the list, but I don't want to bore you. This is only my second point. I'm overworked and overwhelmed, and it would be fantastic if we could change something. Because I know there are so many others like me. I know it's not just me. And it's just not fair. We shouldn't have to face this sort of nonsense. We really shouldn't. My third point was, I thought of that when I was trying to think about my past experience, and I was trying to think about the situations in which I experienced sexism and Islamophobia. And then I thought that the biggest challenge I've encountered in the last 35 years was actually being a parent. And things started to become really, really difficult when I became a parent. I actually had one of my most negative memories in that regard actually happened here at the LSE when, as a master's student, I went to see my advisor to ask him if he would be happy to write a reference letter for me, because I was planning to apply to study in the US. And he looked at me and laughed and said, "But what about your family, Jennifer?" And looking back, I just can't believe he actually said that. I can't believe that I didn't say anything. But these sort of situations, they're sometimes... It's sometimes a bit, it might be a very strong comparison, but it's really a bit sometimes like being in a domestically violent relationship. You don't actually realize what happens until much later when you take a step back and you're like, whoa, did I really allow people to do that to me? Did I really allow people to say these sort of things to me? I really want to go and see him and tell him. Yeah, but then again, I'm tired, and I'm tired of having to point it out to people, and I'm tired of reactions. Like, so many times I've actually told people, and they still couldn't see it, and they still probably wanted to, but they couldn't. I come from Germany. In Germany, we have family allowances for when you get a fellowship. You get a family allowance, for God's sake. What you get here in the UK, you get nothing. You get your PhD scholarship. I was so thankful to have it. It was amazing. It allowed me to actually do this PhD. But the fact that I had a daughter, I was like, just deal with it. Yeah. The welcoming lecture in my PhD, the very first event where the vice chancellor greeted everyone, made everyone feel welcome, I missed it because this lecture started at 9 o'clock, which, I'm sorry, is the exact time when I drop my daughter in school. How do people not see that? How do they then take it into account? I don't understand it. Yes, okay, maybe there's no money for the family allowances. And we all know there is money. It's just a matter of priorities. But for God's sake, like, how hard it is to bear in mind that people might have children, and it's hard for them to attend a meeting that starts at 9 o'clock. I leave it at that. I could go on and on and on, but I leave it at that. Point number four is that, yes, I'm tired and I'm angry and I'm disappointed. I'm really, really disappointed in a lot of my colleagues who are just not as supportive as I think they should be. But at the same time, there's also, there's really, really positive aspects. And there's things that I've come across in the last couple of years that I wouldn't want to miss. And they're linked to all this nonsense, all this racist and sexist, Islamophobic nonsense. And it's the people that you meet on the way and the people who do support you and the people who are on your side. So many times I've attended a conference. And again, I was the only visibly Muslim woman in the room. There was not a single black face. There was maybe one brown face. But then all of a sudden you do see another hijabi or you do see another Muslim students. And I've become like really, really good friends with people that I met in situations like this, where this racism, Islamophobia, and so on that we faced really brought us together. So I'm trying to focus on that as well, on the solidarity that does exist after all. And also something that I'm starting to realize, that I've started to realize in the last years, is that, yes, you do face these barriers, and it's really, really hard, and you shouldn't have to, but overcoming them can be extremely empowering. It can make you so much stronger, and it can actually be a really positive experience. And I don't say that to downplay any of what is happening. It is wrong. It shouldn't happen. And the oppression we face is real. But at the same time, I think it's important to bear in mind that it's not all doom and gloom, and there's actually really beautiful things that we come across as well, that we experience. I wrote down a couple of points on what to do, because so far this has pretty much been a long rant and not much else. I have a few points, but they largely overlap with what Joanne said. So I think in the interest of time, I just leave it at that. Maybe one thing that I would like to say for those in the room who also, or maybe also later, listen to this podcast, and who also face issues like that, who face sexism or Islamophobia and racism and so on, is that I know it's easier said than done, but I would I say this to myself. I just try not to let them stop me, and I just try to be bold nonetheless, and I'll go to the conference. Figure out stuff as best as I can. With the childcare, I make compromises, but I go and I put on my pink hijab and I try to own the room as much as I can, and I try not to let them intimidate me. I also take time to calm down and look after myself afterwards, which is really important too, because this can be really, really draining. But I try not to let them stop me. And I think the fact that I'm a bit like the stubborn German in me, like this helps, right? It's like, and I try to ask my colleagues. They can tell you stories. And I try to channel like this anger that I have. I try to channel it, then like try to make it do something positive. It works sometimes, not all the time. And I also try, I try to stay kind, which can be really, really hard sometimes. But I try not to lose the kindness in me, because it can do that to me, and it can make you really, really angry, and it can make you really, really, it can make you hard, but you don't want to be hard. So I try to find a balance between the two. Yeah, the anger is there, and it's okay, and it's justified, for God's sake. So I'm not trying to shame anyone for the anger. It's there, and it's a reason it's there, because this is really some things that happen that we face on a daily basis are really not on. But I try to bear in mind that I don't want it to change me too much. I was thinking of that, John, when you spoke about people that you engage with, and how do you try to make them understand that maybe it is important to bear these issues in mind. It's hard to speak to people when you shout at them. Like, it's hard to make them listen when you just shout at them, and when you lose this love inside you for people.
All right. Hi, Karen Smith. I'm a professor of international relations here. And it's somewhat disheartening to listen to younger colleagues talk about those experiences. I once heard a quip, I think it was Madeleine Albright, I'm not entirely certain, that you don't start off as a feminist, but you sure do end your life as a feminist, because as you grow older, you are so aware of the ceiling on top of you. And it becomes ever more apparent. So I'm afraid I'm not possibly going to give that much more hope to you. I'm also the chair of the Equality and Diversity Subcommittee in the International Relations Department, and one of the things that we have done this year was to put on a so-called competition, asking students to come up with proposals on how we could celebrate diversity in international relations. And this roundtable won. You weren't bold enough, I think, in acknowledging this fact. The proposal for this roundtable won that competition, so I'm delighted that then Andrew and Ida asked me to participate in it. What I wanted to do, I think, was to talk about diversity at a number of levels in the profession. I say levels, they aren't necessarily levels, but I couldn't think of a better term. So anyway, the first level is the ecosystem of universities, that we need to protect diversity here. In other words, we cannot all be Harvard. This is actually tougher than it seems. This is large research universities in Britain, I think there is a tendency to assume that we can all be Harvard at, you know, one-twentieth the budget. But I think that, in other words, we need to guard against pressures to homogenize the way that academic departments are set up and universities are run. There needs to be diversity there. Then there's within the profession, the level of the wider profession. And here, I think there's also a necessity to protect and celebrate diversity. We all can't publish in international organization or ISQ or wherever. There needs to be a wider appreciation of the quality of research. Here is where we are really up against the ref and promotion criteria and all that. But I think that, again, the rush to homogenize, needs to be slowed down. Otherwise, we really do lose diversity. So there's a level of the university ecosystem, diversity within the profession as a whole. And then we come to diversity of staff, shall we say, of those who profess, the lecturers, the professors, and so on and so forth. And here, protecting or promoting or celebrating or whatever diversity is clearly a challenge. We are grateful for the fact that we have much more research on the extent of the problem, but that doesn't make it any easier to solve. So, for example, we know that there is bias in teaching evaluation, right? If you are a woman, then you are going to be marked down or not marked as high as you might have been otherwise. And this can be by both female and male students. How to tackle that is very difficult, especially when teaching evaluations then feed into promotion applications. I don't have an answer. I'm just saying there's a problem there, right? We know there's extensive research on citation gaps, for example. This is not just the reading list. This goes beyond the reading list. This is citation gaps in the literature. How to solve that other than always citing yourself? I'm not quite sure, but certainly there needs to be more attention there. There are problems, I think, also at conferences. Like you said, I mean, my conference going plummeted after I became a mother. That's it. I don't do it. You know, and I don't try to do it. I just don't do it because it's just too, it's entirely too difficult. But that is, I can do that at my the stage that I am in without any cost. But then there's, you know, these lost opportunities for networking when so much gets done via networking is important, especially when a lot of the networking happens in pubs after you know, when you're supposed to be at home, well, when you want to, you know, you might want to be with your kids or whatever. So that's a problem. You know, the informal nature, I think, of some of the ways in which people get ahead in the profession is difficult. Reference letters, you know, one of the just in the last 24 hours, I have become extremely well depressed and a bit angry. One of the things that we did in the Equality and Diversity Committee was, in fact, to push at school level. A kind of a set of guidelines on how people who write reference letters to for people who are applying for jobs here, a set of guidelines on how they could limit unconscious bias in reference writing. I have discovered that actually it went nowhere. So we have to fight this fight again, and it gets very tiring to keep trying to do that. There are issues about unequal work distribution. There are issues that, at the fact, I think I called it the burden of representation. That if you are in a more minority position, you end up doing more simply because you end up being the person that you know, other than the normal advising and whatnot tasks, you end up with a bit more. Turning that down is very difficult, but it is a burden. And I think, you know, my advice to anybody would be, you got to protect yourself also. You have to think of yourself. I was going to say bring out the inner bitch, but then you were like, be kind. I'm like, oh, no, no, bring out the inner bitch. I don't know. I'm working on the inner bitch thing. But anyway, so that's sort of the level of who teaches, right? Promoting diversity in that respect. And then there's the diversity of offering to students, what students learn, what we are teaching our students in international relations. And here I think there is the issue of the reading list diversity. There's a lot of pushback on that. But the points that I made above about appreciating quality of research, even if it's not in traditional outlets, I think feeds into that. But that's going to be a long, slow process. So there's diversity on the reading list, so what we want our students to read, but then there's also what we want to teach them in terms of subject matter. And there, you know, a wider view of IR and all the rest of it would be wonderful. That's also a slow process because then you need the people to teach it, and you know, we're talking, you know, years of change, I think. So I think celebrating, protecting, and promoting diversity at all those levels are very important, but that we're in a long-term game, as it were. So I just wanted to say a few words about what we've recently been trying to do in the International Relations Department's Equality and Diversity Committee. And we've tried to raise awareness. I'm now thinking, yeah, well, you know, that's it's not enough to raise awareness. So there was the work on the reference letter and so on. On this excellent research that our PhD students, or former PhD students, now have also done on reading lists, trying to raise awareness on that. We're also working on trying to understand the causes of what's called the BME attainment gap. That is, that students who have gained similar A-level marks, who are from white backgrounds or from BME backgrounds, do differently. They come out, you know, there's a gap where you would expect people getting 3 A's or 3 A stars or whatever in A-levels. What you would expect them to get at the end of the university, at the end of the 3 years, differs between white students and BME students, and we want to get to try to understand more about that. So we're doing, and Anissa, who couldn't be here, has written a report for us and is helping us work on how we can figure out in a qualitative way, rather than just using quantitative research, the sources of that BME gap. And then we sponsored this diversity, celebrating diversity competition, which I hope will be an annual event now, so getting the students involved, getting their ideas involved, because by the time I think you get to the sort of, I think one tends towards cynicism, possibly, at this age, aware of all of those institutional, systemic institutional constraints, and so we need the younger generations, the newer colleagues, bringing in these new ideas about how to tackle and celebrate diversity in international relations. So I will end there.
Hello, everyone. My name is Karem Nishanjola. I'm a lecturer in international politics at the University of Saras. It's not called the University of Saras, just Saras. I was joking with Robbie and Karen earlier on, just before the panel started, that I was really uncertain about what to say today, mainly because I've been thinking about a lot of these things for quite a while, and I've thought about them so long that I've got myself into like quite a bit of confusion. I'm kind of unsure about what precisely my position is on some of the questions and prompts that were raised by Andrew at the beginning. I also had the luxury of being the penultimate speaker, so I get the opportunity to reflect on some of the things that others have said. But with those two things together, one thing, and this is a trick for any one of you who has to speak on a panel or speak at an event in the future, keep this in your toolbox. And whenever you're sort of unsure about what to say, just question the premise of the entire event.
You must write for spite.
I'm not that trolling. No. I'm not that much of an arsehole either. I think it's important because I think something that's often missed when we're talking about things like diversifying is a clarification on precisely what we mean by it and also what it's for. I think one thing that I'll be really interested in hearing from other panelists and also from you all is some like idea of what you think diversifying is for. And I have my own suspicions and answers to that and or own hunch about what precisely diversifying is for. And I guess one of the reasons why I want to raise that as a prompt or as a question is to encourage us to move away from thinking about diversity as a practice or performing diversity in and for itself and seeing it as an end in itself. Because I think what happens when people talk about diversity in such terms is that we forget to talk about the things that it really should be challenging, which is racism and whiteness. And I think that hasn't been, that sometimes gets lost in discussions around diversity, specifically what the challenge is. And what often also gets forgotten is why diversity is on the table in the first place. And that is because of the long durational struggles of anti-racist activists and anti-racist organizations and movements that have been taking place from universities to the streets. And I think all of that's really important to acknowledge when we're talking about diversity. And in particular, I want to raise that because there are a number of really important criticisms of diversity politics that have been developed in and through anti-racist praxis. One of which, I've got a set of notes and I've got them sort of scattered, which sort of reflects my own scattered thinking about this between my phone and on paper. So I'll try to work through it. But one of the sort of like famous criticisms of diversity comes from Sara Ahmed, who reminds us of the ways in which by practicing diversity, all we're often doing is giving an institution such as a university the right image. And what it tends to do in doing so is make us simply more comfortable with whiteness rather than challenging whiteness itself, or more comfortable with navigating racism rather than challenging racism itself. Often this is sort of like accompanied by really sort of like individuated conceptions of what we need to be doing as diversity work, right? So rather than challenging institutional racism or challenging racism as something that's structural, we're often found that we're trying to change people's minds on an individual level, and that the correction to racism is just simply fixing some problematic psychological disposition in an individual. And I think that misses the trick in some respects. And it also doesn't help understand why, despite all of this diversity work, racism, and white supremacy, whiteness still persists in institutions such as universities. all of those criticisms have prompted a very different kind of politics around a similar impulse, which is, by the impulse, I mean anti-racist politics. So something that I've been personally involved in is, I guess, a politics around the institution of the university and beyond that has used decolonizing rather than diversity as its heading or as its rubric or as its starting point. And I think one of the things that decolonizing does that diversity sometimes doesn't is that it doesn't necessarily seek the rehabilitation of the white university. It doesn't seek to rescue the white university from itself. It says that the white university is already compromised. And instead it argues that, or instead it poses the question, what is the university? How does it function? And it questions the university and looks at the university as a corporate entity in and of itself, or as a node in wider structures and practices of colonial power that continue today, but have also existed historically. Maybe in the Q&A I can talk about more concretely about what decolonizing has meant in practice. And there's been a number of interesting campaigns and attempts at institutional reform at SOAS and also in other places. The reason why I was so uncertain was that my plan was initially, and what I've done in the past is, diversity is great, it's useful, but it has limits, therefore decolonize. I'm starting to feel uneasy with the discourse of decolonizing itself. And the reason I'm starting to feel uneasy about the discourse of decolonizing is because, like the anti-racism that drove diversity politics, decolonizing is increasingly being co-opted by universities, by universities in ways that seek to once again reconcile itself with racism and whiteness. And it's in particular doing so because, like diversity, decolonizing can be mobilized as a comparative or competitive advantage that universities can then mobilize and use to do things like attract new students, sell students degrees at exorbitant fees and so on. So I have a slight concern that decolonizing is also being subject to some of the similar forces that diversity politics has been in the past, which is to say a set of tokenistic gestures, a set of questions around representation, rather than substantial challenge to the work inner workings of the university. I think what I'd like to do in questioning the premise of the event is ask what do we mean by diversity and why we should diversify, or if perhaps more appropriately, is it possible to diversify? Diversify is the wrong term here. Is it possible to decolonize the university? I guess that's really what my prompt is. Or if we're diversifying, what are we diversifying for? And I think this relates back to some of the things that Joanne was saying. I just wanted to say that some of the things that Joanne said, if you want to know more about it, Joanne and Andrew have written a great article on diversifying the curriculum, which you can find in on a website website called The Disorder of Things. If you want to know more about some of the things and some of the prompts that they raised, please do check that out. I guess I want to sort of like go back to Joanne's first point, which is that representation matters, and suggest a counterpoint to that. And it's not my words; it's the words of Hannah Black, who tweeted this. She's an artist, and I don't know if she'd like to describe herself as an activist, but is. She said, quote, "There's nothing at all wrong with affirming individuals and positive representation, but I still think political action is only truly transformative when it's collective and destructive in some way." And I think that's a really important prompt because it encourages us to think about precisely what sort of destructive behaviours we should be involved in, and hence my encouragement for you to think about, I guess, whiteness and racism rather than diversity. It also encourages us to think about this as a collective endeavour, and to think about what sort of collectivities and what sort of infrastructures that enable collective action, how they might be built and utilised. I think that's especially important when we think about all of the prompts for concrete action that we've seen when thinking about diversity or decolonising. So one example is one popular example is the syllabus or a reading list. And I think one thing that's really interesting about a syllabus and a reading list is that it never just stays one person's property. And what you'll find, especially in the contemporary context of universities and increasing work precarity, but also other sort of institutional features such as research leave, sabbatical, and so on, that other people take courses that you may have designed. So for example, if you're teaching a course like Introduction to International Relations, it's likely that you might be teaching that for 1 or 2 years, and then you'll move on to a different course, perhaps a course that's based on your own research, and that'll pass on to someone else. So with Introduction to International Relations, for example, at SOAS, I was teaching that for 2 years. And in the course of that 2 years, I made some moves to decolonize the curriculum, and that primarily was oriented around reframing the beginning of the course so that it centered questions of colonialism and associated questions of capitalism, racism, patriarchy, and so on. And that was the starting point from which we then subsequently looked at more typical or conventional topics such as realism and liberalism. After vacating that course, which I did this year, that syllabus got changed back. So it started with liberalism and realism with post-colonialism somewhere later down the line. And so I think that what that indicates is that there are sort of structured features of the university as an institution that render us individuals and practice our activity as individuals, which make it difficult, really difficult, I think, to provide any kind of like lasting change that decolonizing or diversifying practice might seek to affect. And so I would encourage thinking beyond the politics of rehabilitating the university or changing the university and think about the politics of forming collectivities and of destroying things that we don't like. I'm aware it's becoming increasingly rambling, so I'll finish there. Thank you for listening.